Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Yesterday, the California State Assembly passed a bill expanding conservatorship laws to include people struggling with severe mental illness and substance use disorders. The State Assembly voted 61-0. The bill, SB 1045, established a five-year pilot program that authorizes San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego counties to create a new conservatorship focused on, quote, providing critical services and housing to the most vulnerable Californians who suffer from mental health and substance issues and who cannot care for themselves, end quote. In San Francisco, this would apply to between 50 and 100 people who need emergency medical services. This is according to the Department of Public Health. The question is, who makes these decisions? We'll talk about that on today's show. The bill was authored by State Senators Scott Wiener and Henry Stern, and it's sponsored by San Francisco Mayor London Breed. Senator Wiener says, quote, our counties do not have the tools they need to effectively help individuals suffering from severe mental health and substance abuse disorders. This bill makes our conservatorship laws more effective, end quote. Supporters of the bill agree, saying people with mental illnesses should not die on the streets untreated. Opponents say changing the law would deny people their rights by forcing them into treatment. Joining us to talk about the implications of this new bill are three guests. Jennifer Friedenbach is Executive Director of the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco. She's worked for the coalition for 20 years as ED, Organizing Director, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Work Group Coordinator and Fundraiser. The coalition opposes the conservatorship bill. And Jennifer Friedenbach joins me in studio. Hi, thanks for coming in.
Hi, good morning.
Teresa Pasquini is a local, state, and national advocate for reforming and improving the mental health system. Teresa says her 40-year personal experience with her son and her brother drives her passion to improve care for those who suffer from serious mental illnesses. Teresa Pasquini is co-founder of Mental Illness Facts, a grassroots campaign focused on quality standards and equity in care for serious mental illnesses in California's public health delivery systems. And Teresa's son has been conserved for the last 18 years, and she joins us from El Sobrante. Hi, Teresa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
And we're joined by John Snook. John is Executive Director of the Treatment Advocacy Center, a national nonprofit dedicated to eliminating barriers to treatment for people with severe mental illnesses. John is one of 14 national experts appointed by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to guide a new federal initiative to better serve those with serious mental illnesses. And John joins us on the line from Arlington, Virginia. Hi, John. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. Great to have all of you. Let's start off by talking about the very basics. Jennifer Friedenbach with the Coalition on Homelessness, let's start off with you. What exactly is conservatorship?
So the way it works now is that you have to be a harm to self or others or gravely disabled, and typically a police officer would pick you up and bring you to a locked facility at Psych Emergency at San Francisco General. And then the medical staff there would do an assessment. If they felt that you did indeed meet the criteria, they can hold you, you know, up to 72 hours to do that assessment. They refer you to the conservatorship office, which is someone who is an office that works within the bureaucratic constructs of the Human Service Agency. And then if they decide that you should be conserved and you meet that criteria, then you go through a process of having you conserved, which basically means that you're losing all of your civil liberties. The state is now taking responsibility for your care.
There's so many questions to ask you just about the whole process, and we'll talk about that throughout the show. But how does this new California bill change that process?
Yeah, so what the bill is doing is it's creating kind of a new avenue, so to speak, for folks where Right now you have the conservatorship, which is the LPS law, Lateran Petra Short. And then you also have in the state of California what's called Laura's Law, which is the the assisted outpatient treatment, which is basically forced outpatient treatment is through the court process also. And so this is a whole new avenue that's a new process outside of those two. And basically, it adds some criteria where if you have a serious mental illness and a serious addictive disorder, you would qualify. And if you've been detained more than 8 times, so there's some, language in there to kind of categorize how you would qualify. And then, you would still, though, have the same process. It's kind of hard for people to conceive, but basically the way it would work from a practical perspective is that it would have the same avenue in as the current process of getting what they call 5150'd, where a police officer brings you into psych emergency. They do the assessment, and let's say in the hospital you don't meet the LPS standard, they would then look and see if you meet this new standard. And then if they do, it would go from there in terms of taking away your civil liberties.
That is Jennifer Friedenbach, Executive Director of the Coalition on Homelessness, explaining how conservatorship actually works. Teresa, you have very personal experience with this. Your 34-year-old son, Danny, was diagnosed with schizophrenia at age 15. And according to a number of articles I've read about you and your family, it was a very harrowing odyssey through 9/11 calls, ER visits, hospitalizations at facilities across the state. Can you talk about how you were all affected by conservatorship? And did you even know about this process before your son was diagnosed with schizophrenia at age 15?
So, yeah, thank you. I am the proud mom of an adult son with schizophrenia who has an addiction history and has been homeless and housed in multiple psychiatric institutions off and on since he was 16. And so because the system wasn't designed to give him the care he needed, he's really been lost and locked away out of sight and out of mind for the last 20 years. When my son was diagnosed, started displaying symptoms early on, I was like, okay, I know what this is because I have an older brother who also suffers from the same illness. We can deal with this. We're going to get him the help he needs. And although we had the resources, we had insurance, private insurance, I was a stay-at-home mom, I could become his full-time case manager, it was a nightmare to enter into the system. You feel like you're hit by a train, and then the more you learn about the system of no care, really, the more desperate, families become. So I made a decision that I was going to keep my son out of jails and prisons because I had a psychiatrist tell me early on, actually, that he would be lucky if he got into the criminal justice system. And I couldn't believe he was saying that to me. But I realized that was, later on, it was because he was saying that's where we provide these services in our current system. And I refused to accept that. I learned everything I could about the laws, and including conservatorship laws. And it was when my son was 18 and had fallen off the cliff of adult services where families are locked out from help, he became so seriously ill and was conserved by Contra Costa County, I believe at the age of 18, and only has been off that conservatorship once for a 2-week period of time where he was found threatening suicide on a local BART track and has been continuously conserved since. So it is you know, beyond time for there to be a reality check in California about the suffering of not only those people that are visible on our streets, but several that are locked in our jails, our prisons, have died and have already died. They're in the graveyard. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate this bill. I appreciate the authors of this bill and the intent, but I don't believe it goes far enough. And there's nothing civil or right about what my son's endured for the last 20 years. And I think that continuing to study suffering is outrageous. We already know what to do. We need to start doing it.
Teresa, you just said that you have health insurance. You were a stay-at-home mom, so you were able to take care of your son. But you said that this is a system of no care. Can you elaborate on that, especially for people who don't really have experience in this area of health care?
So, yeah, I mean, we had private insurance in the most integrated, healthcare system in California. And it was a nightmare. So insurance doesn't guarantee you access, if there is no system of care. And while the insurance did allow my son to, often receive an acute bed, it didn't allow him to come back and have the sustained community care that he needed in order to prevent returning to a locked facility.
Yeah.
We fought to keep his insurance, his private insurance, until he was 26, and actually had to be, we were advised to drop it so that he could get access to facilities that only took Medicaid.
Wow.
So, which is where he is now, doing fabulously, I would like to say.
I was going to ask you, how is he doing today?
He's doing amazing. I keep a running diary of his journey on Facebook. He has a wide national support group across this country, people that are following our story, my fellow advocates and other families that, we've shared his story in order to shatter the silence and the shame that comes with serious mental illness. I have to say it comes not from the stigma of mental illness, because I don't believe there is stigma to being seriously mentally ill. I think it's the gross discrimination that our families are experiencing. And it's not just in California, and actually California is grossly missing the mark, especially since we have so much funding available to prevent the suffering.
Jenny, you wanted to jump in?
I just wanted to add to that, and I, appreciate your struggle. And we have a system, from our perspective, that is completely oriented around the high-end system of care. And so we neglect people, we deny them treatment for what is a medical condition, and then people get worse and worse, and then we rely on locked facilities, on people entering the system through handcuffs. A majority of people's first experience with our mental health system is coming in through the police. And it's just not right. And we need to shift that entire paradigm around, so that there is, different levels of care for people. And I think, for us, we're talking about the homeless population in particular. Homelessness itself is extremely traumatizing. And so for folks there, if they have psychiatric conditions, the episodes are more frequent, they're more debilitating, and they get worse and worse the longer they're forced to stay on the streets, until we get to a point where then, okay, we lock them up and then we start churning them through the system. Right. Last year, we had 1,300 people that were 5150'd and then released back to the streets with no care at all. Right. And that is the part that we want to get at, and that's what we're working on, and trying to build up a system so we don't wait until people are in such bad shape. For us, this bill is really going at it, the lazy kind of, you know, silver bullet, typical politician way where we're just going to do something that sounds good in a soundbite, but in reality is not going to change the real barrier for folks, which is the complete lack of anywhere for people to be placed.
The specific bill says that people will be provided with wraparound services. What about that part of it?
It doesn't have any funding to do that.
No funding.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, the way it's going to end up coming down locally is that it's not going to happen. I mean, it's not going to make any real impact because unless you put real resources into this, you're not going to have placements for people in the community. You're going to still end up the conservators all across the state oppose this, and their statement is that we are taking on responsibility as a state for this person. If we don't have a placement, we're not going to conserve them, and that's the current problem. We don't have places for people to go. We worked really hard in San Francisco to have it so people weren't just conserved in locked facilities, etc., but there's just no placements. I mean, we have right now to get supportive housing for homeless people in San Francisco, you have to have been homeless on the streets for 21 years in San Francisco. Wow. And you have to prove that. Wow. So, you know, we're going to put people into a hospital and then what? Like, what are we doing? And so we're going to keep them in locked facilities forever. They're going to end up stabilizing, being indoors, and they're going to get released back out. I mean, this isn't going to change that paradigm. We absolutely need to build up our system of care, and that's the direction we should be going in. We need to do it the real way. And we're trying to do that with Prop C in November, which would infuse about 70 to 75 million specifically into mental health and substance abuse treatment and do it in San Francisco. So we can at least go back to having a decent system of care in San Francisco like we did in the late 1970s.
John, where does the Treatment Advocacy Center stand on this conservatorship bill?
So I think there's a lot that people have said that we very much agree with. I think it is very true that California fails the most seriously mentally ill. At the end of the day, though, it's almost embarrassing we need to have this conversation at all. This is such a minor change, and it is such a outdated concept that we're arguing about, that to say we're worried about this sort of issue really belies the realities of serious mental illness. About half the country has implemented standards that are much broader than what's even being discussed here. I think if you think about it as just a person on the street, this doesn't apply until you've been picked up 8 times already. That's a ridiculous standard. If this was any other illness, this would be how we would set up malpractice suits. Say, we're not going to provide this person care until they've been, you know, had a heart attack 8 times. And that's basically what we're talking about. Most states now, a majority of states, have implemented standards that look at things like, is the person both mentally ill and unable to understand that they need care? And are they deteriorating? That's the sort of standard that gets away from this idea of, is the person dangerous, which is very stigmatizing and ultimately doesn't work. And I would take a bit of issue with the idea that we need to put more money into California's system. The reality is Prop 63 has poured money into California's system, but it's being wasted. The Little Hoover Commission looked at the amount of money that's sitting on the shelf, found that it was over $1 billion just sitting in 2017 because it isn't being used correctly. And this is one of those reasons. If you're talking about a person who has a serious mental illness and you say the only way you get into treatment is if you're able to volunteer for care, and if you can't, we're going to wait until you're dangerous. And that's what people see when they go to the Tenderloin. Tons of people desperately in need of care, but who aren't yet violent, but who are too sick to volunteer for care.
But if you talk to those same people, because we're very deeply rooted in the Tenderloin, what we find is that people are asking for care. They're asking for care over and over again, and they're being denied care. Every day I talk to people, every day our outreach workers talk to hundreds of people who have mental health issues that are trying to get some help that aren't getting any care. And so that, to the Prop 63 issue is that the funding source is very volatile and the income source goes up and down. We're not, in San Francisco, we're spending that money. We've cut a whole bunch of stuff that was funded by Prop 63 because of that volatility. But it's that's the piece that needs to be corrected. But you can't expand our system. you know, in San Francisco, in order to get residential treatment, you have to have been hospitalized so many times. That's how they prioritize it. So if you rack up enough costs to the city, then they end up giving you residential treatment. There's no way for folks that are out on the streets to be able to get the care that they need. There's no way for them to do it. There's no place. We have one place that is a crises clinic in San Francisco where you can stay. It only has room for 17 people. I mean, it's we have to expand our city, our services, or there's not going to be places for people. And we also know what works. You know, when we work with people regularly, you know, when folks are not going into services, it's a systemic failure, not an individual failure. We got to stop blaming people because what we have in our system isn't working for them. When it works for them, then it works. When it doesn't work, when we're offering something that doesn't, you know, this presumption that everyone that has a mental illness is unable to make decisions for themselves.
I very much worry about that reality going out to the general public because it's just unfair. These are people who have a serious mental illness, and you're saying if we just have the right level of voluntary care, if we just offer them the right thing, suddenly they'll participate. But what we're actually talking about, and what people listening need to understand, is when you see that homeless person who's psychotic, they, for all intents and purposes, are drowning. And what you're saying is, well, we just need the lifeguards to offer the right sort of life vest. We need to make the right sort of rescue. And that's just not the reality. That's not what the research says. The research says there is a significant population that requires something more than voluntary care. And you are exactly right. California has wasted Prop 63 money for years. California has used it on things like yoga and just on programs that everyone on the street says, that won't help someone with serious mental illness. I know the reality. Unfortunately, what we're talking about now is still allowing people to deteriorate. And all of the evidence tells us when you allow people to get so sick that they're violent to someone else, it's so much harder to get them back into care. So I think we agree almost 100%. We're saying the same things. It's just a matter of, do you have all of the tools in the toolbox you need to get that person care?
Yeah, this is Teresa, and I appreciate, you know, what you're saying, Jennifer, but I have to agree with John completely. And I've been a very loud, I've spoken out loudly against the waste of Prop 63, and, you know, and have partnered with anybody and everybody that will work with me to bring oversight and accountability. Not only to my local county, but I'm a former mental health commissioner in Contra Costa County for 9 years, and I watch the implementation of the act. And while I know there's some wonderful programs that are helping people and doing great things, there's too much waste, there's too much stakeholdering, there's too much chit-chat while people are actually dying, not only on our streets, again, but in our jails and in their parents' back bedrooms. I mean, we have a lot of family members who are helping, you know, trying to do their best to help their loved ones that would do anything to keep their loved one from becoming homeless or gravely disabled or dangerous to self and others. But this is a system that forces that to happen. And it's really shameless that it's happening while California counties are collecting interest on billions of dollars. So I testified at the Little Hoover Commission, and I think it's a myth that there's volatility in this funding stream. I think the funding stream has been pretty steady, and I think everybody agrees and has agreed for some time that there's something wrong with the process. And quite frankly, I don't believe that the law was ever implemented as the voters intended. And I think it's time for California to really, you know, stop tinkering around the fray. And, you know, I would agree with you, Jennifer. It is time for a complete system of care. And there is limited access to the services that people need and want. And I think there's also a system that's been designed to harm the providers in our system as well. And I think we all are wanting the same thing. And I again appreciate the efforts of the authors of this bill and their intention, but it grossly misses the mark. And I'm not in favor of more pilots, more opt-ins, or, you know, ignoring families like mine who are forced to make our children dangerous to self and others in order to save their lives. It's time really to scale up and provide a right to treatment before tragedy in all 58 counties, not just three.
We're going to take a quick break. That is Teresa Pasquini, a local, state, and national advocate for reforming and improving the mental health system. Teresa says her 40-year personal experience with her son and her brother drives her passion to improve care for those who suffer from serious mental illnesses. John Snook is executive director of the Treatment Advocacy Center, a national organization dedicated to eliminating barriers to treatment for people with severe mental illnesses. And Jennifer Friedenbach is executive director of the Coalition on Homelessness. She's worked for the coalition for 20 years. As executive director, she's also been a substance abuse and mental health work group coordinator, and they oppose the conservatorship bill. We're talking today about conservatorship. Yesterday, the California State Assembly passed a bill expanding conservatorship laws to include people struggling with severe mental illness and substance use disorders. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on our media roundtable, we'll discuss the backlash against Venezuelan refugees in Brazil. Millions of Venezuelans have fled to neighboring countries due to the economic crisis in Venezuela and shortages of food and other essentials. We'll also talk about Donald Trump's announcement to pursue a new trade pact with Mexico to replace NAFTA. How are reporters covering NAFTA's impact on workers and the environment? That is on our next media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today we are talking about conservatorship laws. And yesterday, the California State Assembly passed a bill expanding conservatorship laws to include people struggling with severe mental illness and substance use disorders. Supporters say people with mental illnesses should not be dying on the streets untreated. Opponents say the law denies people their rights by forcing them into treatment. We're joined by John Snook, executive director of the Treatment Advocacy Center. Teresa Pasquini is an advocate for reforming and improving the mental health system. She has very personal experience with this issue and conservatorship. And Jennifer Friedenbach is executive director of the Coalition on Homelessness. Just quickly before we get to calls, Who makes these decisions? I'm thinking, Jenny, of a woman in my neighborhood. She's probably in her 60s. She's always sleeping on the ground. And when we see her, we buy her dinner and try to chat with her. Sometimes we're able to have a conversation, but other times it just doesn't make sense. And she's really thin, and she's just wandering the streets. And I'm looking at her thinking, would the city decide that she is a candidate to go into treatment? And how does that work?
Yeah, so typically it's the front end entrance is going to be through the police. And I think that's also an important thing to think about, because, you know, we want to engage people in treatment. We want to have them be active participants in their recovery and wellness. And, you know, it kind of sets up a certain dynamic oftentimes when it's at the police. And then, you know, and you're getting transported. So at that point, they're basically the front end. And then from there, and there are some social workers that can do this, but that's pretty rare. Typically, it's going to be through the police. And then the decision maker at that point is going to be typically at San Francisco General, probably Dr. Bland, who runs the psych emergency there, is going to decide whether, you know, if they don't meet LPS criteria, whether they meet this new criteria or not. And so there's decision making there. And then there's then decision making through the courts. So if the person then gets referred on, ultimately, you know, you have a right to counsel. So you'd have the public defender involved. You have a right to a jury trial. So you then have these all these other decision makers, you know, in the process, which is part of our issue with, you know, having everything going through a court system. And there's this idea that, you know, the judges are going to, you know, get people to do things. And we, in our experience, we're able to get even the most severe people, when there's help available, get them help.
And in the case of this woman who really can't explain what's happening to her, someone would be assigned to advocate for her? If she doesn't have family members, is that how it works?
Yeah. So the local city government. So right now it's just for the three cities. They would have to basically put together their own regulations on what that's going to look like. And so in the current LPS, of course, it's the conservator who's overseeing that. And I think the assumption is that with the local implementations, it would also be the conservator.
John, as you know, we have a homeless crisis in this very wealthy city of San Francisco. I mean, it's across California, across the country. But when you're talking about who makes these decisions, how do you determine who needs to be forced into treatment?
I think that's the most important question, and it's, do we think about this issue in terms of dangerousness, or do we think about this issue in terms of how we think about it with every other illness? I think an important thing for your listeners to do is to stop and take a moment and move away from thinking about this sort of illness as different than any other illness. If we were talking about people who had Alzheimer's or who had strokes, and we were saying, well, they're obviously really sick. They obviously don't know how to make an informed decision. They obviously aren't in their right mind, quote unquote. And then we responded, well, we're going to have the cops come once they're finally dangerous. People would be up in arms. And I think that's what we really need to focus on. Unfortunately, California has to rely on police because the standard is so focused on that idea of dangerousness, of you either volunteer for care or you become a danger. And a lot of states now have said that's just a ridiculous way to do things. And we know that doctors aren't very good at guessing when someone's going to be dangerous. What they're much better at doing is determining this person isn't able to make an informed decision about their need for care and that they're deteriorating medically. And that's really what we're trying to get to, is moving California into a place where we say no one cares at the end of the day if this person's ever going to be dangerous. What we need to know is this person sick, and are they well enough to understand they need care? And that's really the population we're talking about. And I think too often these conversations devolve in sort of into a back and forth. But I think at the end of the day, everybody wants to help this population. It's just that the research shows us quite clearly that there is a significant percentage of individuals that the best voluntary services in the world won't get there. And I recognize that the homeless, I'm on the board of a homeless shelter here in D.C., and we go out and meet the homeless, and the homeless advocates and the volunteers do amazing work. But at the end of the day, there's this population that you simply will never be able to convince that, you know, for example, there's someone that I know, she is convinced she owns the local bank. And it's because of her illness. She isn't able to understand that she doesn't own that bank, even with all of the realities around her. And until they provided her with court-ordered care, there was nothing that could be done. And that's really the population that we're talking about when we talk about this most severely mentally ill population. It's those folks that, without more, are simply going to die with their rights on, sitting on the streets.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the research gets a little bit manipulated there, because I've looked at some of the research that you cited, and it indicated that it was actually the presence of services being available. So oftentimes, what we're doing in our systems is we're kind of using this
That's
as a way,
and that's a common mistake. That there's actually pretty clear evidence that they looked at, was it just the services, or was it the services plus the court order? That's really the key. And what they found was, increased services did make an impact, obviously. The more services you have, the better. But increased services plus that court order made a huge difference. It's one of the reasons that the program that had the most research in New York City has been taken up and incorporated in so many states. It's now law in 46 states, and it's become the subject of a federal grant program. And we're starting to see some really exciting evidence out of those communities showing exactly what it means for those folks who are the most ill to finally be in care that works for them.
Yeah, I looked at that same New York study, but I don't think that's what it said. But the thing is that I think, you know, for us, at least at the Coalition on Homelessness, we're not opposed to conserving people in terms of that core question. The problem that we have is that is that we have a system that forces people to get to that place instead of caring for them earlier and backing it up. And we find that this is the political response, is this continual kind of, you know, very surface response that doesn't, you know, the for example, the fact that this bill is not funded at all is an example of that. We have a situation where people are not able to get care and they end up disintegrating. And then the question is, you know, and I think with the, you know, with the LPS, you know, there are reforms that could happen. And if there was any involvement of the mental health consumer community and the development of that, or any more broad conversations, we could have done things to make it better. But these standards that they're talking about don't really get at that. And so for us, what we're talking about in San Francisco is we're talking about people who were very heavily out on the streets and homeless, very heavily targeted by political wedge, you know, creating politicians. We have a lot of pressure on the police to move people, to cite them, to arrest them. It would be very easy for this to be manipulated, to have homeless people on the streets harassed by police, brought in as a punishment. They lose all their survival gear in that process.
Well,
everything gets confiscated. I mean,
right
this
now.
Is, yes, and they'd be able to do it a lot more. And so It is an approach of expanding the part of the system that isn't working instead of looking at the stuff that is working and expanding that.
We have a number of callers on the line. Let's go through a few calls and then we'll get responses from today's guests. Let's hear from Ariana in San Francisco. Hi, Ariana. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hello. I'm a clinical psychologist and I've worked in community mental health for 25 years. And I think part of the issue is that people, including the police, see psychotic people and severely mentally ill and feel frightened by them and by their impulsivity. And I think one attitude to rectify that is to think more about the homeless as our neighbors and part of our community, and that people who are psychotic are not necessarily dangerous. So the public needs to be educated. There needs to be a multi-pronged approach. And even though this is a very expensive problem, we live in quite a violent society that projects its violence abroad and internalizes it with the police. And so there is needed funding for everything. You can't have a bill without funding. They closed the state hospital decades ago, and they didn't fund the community mental health clinics. And we're flooded with clients, and we can't serve them as they need and deserve. So this is a much more complex, multi-layered system with people who've been traumatized very early on in their life, sometimes even in infancy. Mm. And so they need comprehensive care that's hard to deliver and that needs to be long-term. And our society has to wake up to different approaches that are not just quick fixes, taking a pill, forcing medication. Even if drug court is appropriate for some people, or even if conservatorship is appropriate for some people, there's fear on the street among people of color and the poor of the police, and the police fear this, the mentally ill as well, and that's not a good combination.
Well, thank you for calling, Ariana. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's go next to Allison in Oakland. Hi, Allison.
Hello. I'd like to say that this bill is a step in the right direction, maybe a small step compared to what has to be done. But my daughter has been conserved now for a couple of years under a program similar to Laura's Law, and it has extended her life. She was 5150 by the police more than a dozen times before this conservatorship started. She is schizophrenic. She had a delusion that she needed meth to stay alive for her health, and also sometimes for the health of her imaginary unborn baby. So it wasn't realistic to expect her to realize that she needed to be treated for mental illness. She was not aware of having a mental illness and still is intermittently not aware. So conservatorships save lives. It's true that we also need housing and beds. Both hospital beds and unlocked supportive beds for the seriously mentally ill. There's a few dozen of these kind of beds in my county.
that I know of. Places like the Need a House, Synergy, and Cronin, we need many more of those, and the Mental Health Services Act could fund those, can fund those. But our kids have no political power at all to push for these kind of services. They're desperately needed, but the push has to come from everybody else and from the parents. And parents are often pushed out and actively discouraged from intervening in their children's care because of concerns about the patient's autonomy and about HIPAA. The system's a horrible mess, but we have to start somewhere. This is a little start. Another start would be to force counties to spend MHSA money, Prop 63 money, on supportive housing for the seriously mentally ill. Proposition 2 will not do anything for our kids.
Allison, can I ask you just quickly, before your daughter entered into conservatorship, what was the process of trying to get her help? Is your experience similar to Teresa's?
Oh, it's desperate. It's horrible. Mm. There are dozens of bureaucracies you could deal with. They're not responsive. You can call the police. The police might take her somewhere to a hospital. The hospital might say, and this happened many times, you know, after a few hours or a day, oh, you know, she's not gravely disabled. She knows that there's a women's shelter around here somewhere. You know, I got to let her go. There's no space in the hospital. There's only so many beds. We got to turn them over. She had social workers who tried and tried to advocate for her and eventually quit because it's so frustrating dealing with how difficult it is to get help for somebody that's sick.
Wow.
The system is horribly, horribly broken, you know, and we all know that. And, you know, in Modesto the other day, you know, a lady got run over by a truck by some people purporting to be cleaning up a homeless camp. Homelessness is not acceptable. It's not an option, and especially not for our seriously mentally ill kids that don't even know what's going on.
Well, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story, Allison. Thank you. Let's go next to George in San Francisco. Hi, George. George, are you with us? Let's go to Sanger in Berkeley. Hi, Sanger. Oh, are we having phone problems? Martine in Bolinas.
Thank you so much for this program. I also have had experience with family members trying to get help for them, and it's just horrifying. And I'm going to say that so far what I've encountered is programs that rely heavily on forcing toxic medications and using old methods of treatment that have really been proven to make people worse. They disable the brain, and they create side effects that are life-threatening. And we need to look at what's being done in places like Finland and Portugal and places where things are really being done that help people without disabling their brains. We know now that people relapse into psychosis at a higher rate after taking antipsychotics. It makes them more vulnerable to continued psychosis. The drugs cause the terrible side orders. And we know that from studies that people can come through psychosis and out the other end and be reintegrated into their lives in a better state if they're not totally drugged. I know some people do probably really need medication. I wouldn't say never do it, but studies are showing that they commit suicide at rates 20 times higher, schizophrenic patients, than the ones that are not medicated. And I just would like us to see programs that offer alternatives, and I want to recommend, I'll stop right after this, three books. The Ultramind Solution by Mark Hyman, Rethinking Madness came out in 2012 by Paris Williams, Anatomy of an Epidemic, and Robert Whitaker. And Rethinking Madness is the most, it's just amazing, the case studies. And I'd really like to know if, and because I've found no health professionals, also the work of Dr. Peter Bregan, I've found no health professionals or in law enforcement, in the probation department, et cetera, that are dealing with these people who know anything about these works that are based on science and cases.
Well, thank you for calling, Martine. You brought up a number of points there. A number of people are calling in, Jenny, and saying, what if we had universal health care in this country? What would it look like? Because we just did a show about the opioid crisis, and if we had universal health care, we would not have this level of a crisis. in this country.
It is so true. And it's, you know, it's really about having a system that, you know, for example, let's just look at a lot of the folks that are out on the streets. You have a lot of trauma. Getting trauma treatment is almost impossible. You know, one of my close family friends, you know, had a daughter who was raped, and it ended up creating a lot of mental health problems for her. And she has private health insurance, and it was, you know, they had to pay out of pocket for a trauma center for her to stay at that treated the trauma. So, you know, there's so many different elements of our system. So what then ends up happening? You don't treat for trauma, turns into addictive disorders, more mental health crises occur. I mean, and all these other things start happening. And so we need to be thoughtful about it. And just, you know, the quickie answer, and I understand why it's appealing, and I really feel, and I have so many people in my life that, you know, are going through this and trying to help get them care and unable to get care because the system's so messed up. It's really attractive to just make it easier to lock people up. I understand the attraction. And unfortunately, we have a political reality that is not coming from...
John, hold on a minute.
...is not coming from the perspective of a health perspective. It's coming from a perspective of, let's get people who are visible out on the streets invisible. They're not coming at it from a let's care for people perspective at all. And so that's where it starts getting dangerous, and that's where it starts getting abusive. And if I thought that this would lead to people getting care, that we actually had the resources in our system to care for people, I would totally adjust. But I don't see it happening. I see doing the same thing, bringing people in and releasing them to the streets. I don't see anyone talking about that.
Let's get Teresa to respond, and then John. Teresa, what are your thoughts about Jenny's concerns?
I understand that that's a typical ideological argument, and I don't disagree that we need to complete the system of care. We have an incomplete system in this state. And it's shameful considering the amount of money we have. And, you know, creating more boutique programs is not the answer. And I don't believe that this boutique conservatorship program is the answer either. I don't agree with the former caller's concerns about psychiatric meds and whatnot. I mean, I understand, you know, the horrible side effects and whatnot, but my sons have been saved by medication and long-term treatment. And I invite anybody to come and watch the videos that I take of him and hear him in his own voice talk about, you know, how well he's doing. And, you know, he's been forced into treatment, yeah, but he's got his life back. And, you know, he's also been forced into handcuffs, you know, over 50 times for 5150s. And he's been forced into a solitary jail cell after being arrested on a hospital unit where he was sent to receive treatment. And he's been forced to go through numerous court proceedings while waiting for competency to be restored. And he's been forced to miss his sister's wedding and the death of his three grandparents. And so, I know that he is celebrating his health and hope now, and I want us all to get, you know, stop arguing over, you know, over humanity. I mean, we have to get real, and you know, I would agree with Jenny. You know, there is a moral imperative, a moral and fiscal imperative, to reject ongoing discrimination against all people with serious mental illnesses. So, I happen to believe in a right to treatment before tragedy, and I think that there is a lack of knowledge, really, and few people really understand the legal and fiscal discrimination against people with serious mental illness in California, and they don't understand federal and state parity. They don't understand that Medicaid and Medicare are only funded to the extent resources are available. They don't understand that when our legislature cut the 1991 realignment budget last year, that it prevented counties from providing adequate medically necessary treatment in a mental health rehabilitation facility for people with serious mental illness, or the IMD exclusion on the federal basis. So, um, I, you know, I encourage the conversation to continue. I again appreciate the attempts on this, but you know, conservatorship didn't prevent my son from harm or forced treatment, and you know, but it was the only tool in the toolbox that I had to save his life, and I don't regret using it.
John, we have about a minute left. What's your response?
I think Teresa summed up the issue so well, and I really appreciate everyone's focus and care for this population. And I apologize for jumping in. I get very worried when we use pejorative terms around the care of serious mental illness, and I think that idea of throwing it around colloquially that we're going to lock people up is somehow something that we need to do. At the end of the day, what we're talking about is providing medical care in an inpatient facility, and using terms like lock them up when it's actually providing inpatient care is really important, because right now the federal government actively discriminates against the care of serious mental illness. Inpatient hospitalization is literally the only type of illness that Medicaid will not pay to reimburse. And that's because of those sort of discriminatory language that we say, lock them up, when what we're talking about is provide medical care in a facility that helps that person. We don't say that for people who have Alzheimer's disease. We don't say, well, we're going to lock them up because she needs care. We say we're going to provide them care in a locked facility. And that's really important, because otherwise we end up in these situations where people say, oh, he should be arrested. It sounds like they're a criminal. And that's just not the right thing. We need to get away from that sort of thinking.
Jenny, 1 minute.
Yeah, just, you know, really appreciate the dialogue on this. I think, you know, a big important voice that's missing right now is mental health consumers, you know, in this discussion, who do have the right to human dignity and do have a right to self-determination. And yes, there are going to be those very rare occurrences where people are currently conserved. Let's do something that makes sense.
We will bring people on our next show, because we are flooded with emails from families who are talking about how difficult it is to find care for a loved one.
So hard.
So
impossible.
So hard. So yeah. We'll definitely have people with mental illnesses on the next show. Jennifer Friedenbach is Executive Director of the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco. Teresa Pasquini is an advocate for reform on mental health based on a 40-year personal experience with her son and brother. And John Snook is Executive Director of the Treatment Advocacy Center. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.